Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Seed of wisdom, in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. As I mentioned more than once, your questions are indispensable for a clear and deep understanding what I'm trying to share with you. Because the questions reveal what's on your minds. I'm not just teaching in the abstract. I'm teaching human beings. And questions are God's way of showing us what we need to know. And the purpose of education is not to learn everything, but to learn what I need to know. Did we get up to question 101? Oh, 28. I have the wrong manuscript in front of me. 28 reads, what is the Catholic Church's teaching on masturbation? Did we talk about that? Let's read the answer. It is Catholic doctrine that masturbation constitutes a grave disorder. Consequently, and the answers are either verbatim or in paraphrase from, as we've said, mainly two documents of the Holy See. Consequently, when fully consented to by the will, it is a mortal sin. Not surprisingly, there are many who deny this today. By the way, the spelling and other elements of grammar, I assure you, they'll be corrected. I did not do the typing. I have other limitations, but among them is not spelling. They claim, these are the dissenters, claim that psychology and sociology show that masturbation is a normal phenomenon of sexual development, especially among the young. 50 priests change the statement. 50 years in the priesthood have taught me a great deal. One thing I've learned I can share with you. Masturbation, no matter what the age, is devastating. I'm not now speaking on the level of Christian doctrine, but rather on the level of human psychology. Not to control one's sexual impulse and here to derive the most simple, always available, quiet, unknown by anybody else, sexual pleasure called masturbation is always, I repeat that adverb with emphasis, is always psychologically demoralizing. Out of my trainings, I think I've told you, you don't start teaching theology at the age of 37. 37 years, pardon me, 37 minus 6. though the first 6 years I consider in many ways the most important years of my education from my widow mother. That's making now 31 years of formal education. You're bound to learn a few things, and you're about to pick up a few degrees. I have a number of degrees, among which is a graduate degree in psychology. I have more than once served legally, approved by the government, as a psychologist, for people who had to spend, say, 6 to 12 months under psychological care, including a father who spanked his 12-year-old daughter, and she deserved it. But she reported this to the principal. Principal called in civil authorities, and the father was arrested. I repeat, masturbation harms one's psychological stability. Here I got talk for hours. When I give, say, seminars, when I teach moral theology, and have to spend, say, 2 or 3 classes on the subject, of course I go into detail. I know of no single form of self-control that is more important than controlling one's sexual drive. I use the word control because that's, well, psychological lingo. In other words, the pleasure derived from masturbation undermines, and hear it, undermines the whole moral order in the practice of the virtue of chastity. And now, as I'm sure you know, except for a very Catholic psychologist, and I know psychologists, and he or she'd have to be very Catholic, none will tell you that masturbation is bad. On the contrary, it can be even, they tell you, necessary. And this, I can tell you, is found even in books in moral theology for the training of priests. Let me go on. What is the Catholic Church's teaching on masturbation? We just finished that, didn't we? 29. How does masturbation lead to homosexuality? Masturbation, which is not controlled, becomes habitual. As a result, the person, strongly tempted to increase the sexual pleasure by indulging the sexual passion together with another person of the same gender. Thus, homosexuality is really mutual masturbation with a person and without the risk of pregnancy. Number 29 should be etched in bronze. You don't counsel people for 50 years in my priesthood, including homosexuals, are the most unusual days of recollection that I ever gave was in Washington, D.C., to the Missionaries of Charity, who had just established a home for the AIDS patients. And over 5 or more hours that day, I talked to the sisters on how to care for the AIDS patients. There may be exceptions. I know of no single AIDS patient, including those whom I have served on their deathbed, who was not in the habit of masturbating. Am I clear? The sexual pleasure is heightened. And now, in one book defending homosexuality after another, they insert the word love. And they'll tell you, the homophobic people who are against homosexuality do not understand what love means. Well, I think I've told you. The English word love has 2 spellings. I can prove it. I've seen both spellings carved, painted on the walls in the city of New York, where I lived for 14 years. The first spelling is L-O-V-E. The second is L-U-V. In other words, masturbation is devastating in 2 ways. It deeply injures the practice of charity. Oh, please. It's getting late in the afternoon. You must be tired. And please do not forget this. The sexual inclinations that God gave us, and they're very strong. The 2 strongest drives in human nature are to self-preservation by eating and drinking, and the preservation of the human race through the sexual instinct. But we are naturally selfish, spontaneously selfish. The 7 capital sins are 7 expressions of selfishness. And consequently, either this strong drive which God has given us for the procreation and education of the human race is, and it must be, inspired by love, or, and I'm speaking from years of experience, uncontrolled sexual drive in my judgment is a principal cause of crime in the world. That's a large statement. In other words, you talk about masturbation. The sexual pleasure is satisfied. But please don't forget, two virtues go together, and they are chastity and charity. They go together. And my chastity is only as Christian as it is loving. And of course, not loving of the one person who mothers tell me, Father, let me tell you, a child is already self-willed. I'm quoting mothers, before they are born. And mothers who have had several children tell me they can predict what kind of a baby they're carrying. In other words, masturbation is deeply selfish. But all it does when it becomes homosexuality is mutual masturbation, so that each of the two shall be called them partners in homosexual pleasure, increase their respective pleasure, minus the two most basic forms of love that must prevail in authentic Christian chastity, and they are the love of my married spouse and the love of the children whom God wants to send me if it is His will. We go on. How does the theory of the fundamental option, or has it contributed to the modern plague of homosexuality? Some of you may have wondered why, of all the courses I chose as the second of our two courses for this term, is homosexuality. Many reasons. One reason is homosexuality in our country, and not only, but in our nation, is a plague. And the AIDS epidemic has not stopped it. In fact, now, the AIDS victims, who are, of course, suffering, are among the prime movers in it, among the prime promoters of assisted suicide. They're asking, does the theory of the fundamental option contribute to this modern plague? First, let me read a brief resume of the fundamental option theory and then apply it to the subject of our class. according to the fundamental option theory, there is no mortal sin committed unless a person completely rejects God or completely closes himself to the love of others. On these premises, homosexuality would not be committing grave sin. I trust I have, because I have over the years lectured on fundamental option, besides, of course, in teaching it in class. I will never forget one of my Jesuit students from Malta. Upon my door, a theology I was teaching in Southern Indiana, it was just thrilled with pleasure. "Father," he said, "guess what I found in Karl Rahner?" Oh, the Maltese, he could read German. So he showed me a few paragraphs from Karl Rahner's writings. Sure enough, I consider Karl Rahner the genius who invented the theory of the fundamental option. What is the theory? It claims, as we briefly just read, that there is no, hear it, no objective moral sin which is grave before God. And I use the word objective, mortal sin. An abortion is not a mortal sin. Fornication is not a mortal sin. Here, homosexuality is not a mortal sin. It is all in the intention. I've spent days explaining this to my Jesuit students, how pleased I was to see that our present Holy Father brings this out, especially in his document, The Splendor of Truth. One seminary after another, fundamental option is standard, shall we call it, moral teaching. The essence of sin consists in the why, in the intention, and not in the what. I will forbear identifying a widely known Catholic institution of higher learning. There are page after page after page of the class notes used by the students tells them to kill an unborn child is not murder. It's not a grave sin. And consequently, homosexuality is not a grave sin. Only then do you commit a grave sin And the basic principle of the fundamental option is, if you want to reject God, and as a consequence, of course, reject other human beings, well, once you believe that, and our priests who have been so trained and as I say, this young Maltese student in theology were just so thrilled to find this. And I should say, he left my room not smiling, but I think I should say disappointed. But hear it. There may have been others before Karl Rahner. But Karl Rahner was and still is a genius whose teaching on the fundamental option has deeply infected the minds of millions. And this, by the way, in some ways is the main theme of our Holy Father's encyclical Splendor of the Truth. There is an objective order. There are laws which Christ identifies as gravely binding. And just because you knowingly and willingly, in this case, practice homosexuality, you have committed a grave sin. They deny that they totally reject God, and also deny that they completely close themselves to the love of others. In fact, they claim that their homosexuality is an expression of deep love for another person who happens to have the same gender. Moreover, there are professed moralists who defend sodomy as totally consistent with the will of God. Without going into detail, about a year and a half ago, again I was called to Rome, and it was exactly this teaching, having analyzed the writings of a widely known old professor. I was called to Rome, well, to prove to the Holy See that what he was teaching was condemned fundamental option theory. In fact, this small theologian was also summoned to the Vatican. Oh, the pleasure of meeting an intelligent heretic. Sheer joy. And then defend the truth. I think I should say this without identifying him by name. One of my hopes is that in the near future I will be able, and not just on local, but if possible on national television, defend the church's teaching on the sinfulness of homosexuality with a member of the Catholic hierarchy. I will not mention his name. I did tell you, didn't I, that a large TV station in Chicago had tried to bring Hans Kuhn, and my first name is Hans too, but it's John, to debate on television nationally. Hans Kuhn is smart. 3 times he passed down the invitation. He is smart. Having taught Jesuits for 25 years, Hans Kuhn is a low-grade amateur. But this is widely, very widely disseminated in Catholic circles. This is the main reason for the sacrament of confession in some parts of the Catholic world practically has disappeared. In one large archdiocese in the United States, my latest figures are 40 parishes do not hear confessions. They merely give what they piously call general absolution. I think it would be worthwhile. I'm not sure. Can I walk back with this machinery? It is well to know, for the Catholic Church has taught over the centuries, that the Catholic Church has always taught there are 3 elements necessary for a morally good act. I've said this before, but as I've also told you, a good teacher repeats without boring. The word morality is a good synonym for liberty. A moral action is a free action, something which we perform with our freedom. That's a moral act. Now, because we have a free will, our moral actions can be either morally good or morally bad. To be morally good, our action must be good in 3 ways. And I've reduced those over the years in teaching to 3 terms. The what we do must be good. The how we do it must be good. And the why we do it must be good. The what must be good. In other words, the action itself must conform to the will of God. Question: is eating morally good? Are you telling me, therefore, it is not a sin to enjoy a good meal? Are you saying that? I've taught too many married people. I can assure husbands, oh, how they appreciate a good meal. Say, there are chalks that write. A good moral act. A good moral act must be good, as we've just said, in what I do, in how I do it, and in why. We said it can be a good moral act to eat. Is it a good moral act to sleep? I think I told you. Among my letters from my Jesuit provincial is one I've told you this, haven't I? John, he wrote, I hear you're getting 4 hours of sleep. Get 6, since you're yours. Remember I asked, roll back. Does that mean 6 every night or 6 on an average? He wrote back another Dear John letter. Dear John, don't be funny. 6 hours every night. And I got almost, but not quite, 6 hours last night. You cannot do the work which the church gives you without, well, spending time. And most people cannot study or write while sleeping. But now, on the how, can eating, which by itself is morally good, on the what side? Can it be sinful on the how side?
Yes.
For example, how much? It can be sinful, as we know. This is as simple a thing as eating or drinking. May I ask, is it morally good to show your affection for someone? Is it morally good?
Yes.
Does it make any difference on how you show your affection?
Yes.
One block in Detroit would be enough. Just walk down the street and embrace and kiss each person you meet. And by the end of the block, somebody will take you into custody. So it's the what and the how. Oh, lost these keys, pardon me. I have to say Hail Mary. Whenever I find something lost, Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. See, Natalia Padua. Oh, how happy. Thanks, Lord. Now the why. Again, back to the eating and drinking. Of course, that covers the whole ocean of human action. If I'm hungry, last night I had an early breakfast yesterday, and I had to give a talk in Flint. I left Flint, I think around 1 o'clock or 1:30. I came here and got back to my Jesuit residence at about 8:30. And, oh, did that lunch ever taste good? In other words, why do we eat? Well, you might say, to support yourself. I think I should share this with you. One of my Jesuit confreres in Rome was a priest from France, and we'd talk to each other in our respective languages. I could learn more French, he could learn more English. And as we were talking, part of our conversation was what the social scientists say about the food consumption in the United States. I had no reason for doubting his words, but he said, our social scientists in France tell us, it's in our books, that the whole nation of France could be nourished on the amount of food that the United States wastes each year. One of my favorite, some of you may know, would you remember, one of my favorite definition of, well, a materially prosperous country is, where what substitutes for what? Where pastry substitutes for bread. Back to the question why. And I couldn't be more basic and talking about food and drink. There is so much food that the body needs. Some bodies need more than others. And when I had my heart surgery, 81, fully bypassed, and of course, spent almost a month in the hospital, then months afterwards, coming back to the hospital, well, for various kind of training and medication. Most of those who had heart surgery were overweight. Am I making sense? In other words, people will eat and eat, pardon me, and eat. And the recipes of a country like the United States are now in millions of words on how to make food, well, more appealing, more tasteful. And by the way, please, you wives, don't go back home and tell your husbands, "My dear, I think I should let you practice a higher degree of virtue." Hardy, I've been spoiling you by making my food, well, so tasty. There's nothing wrong in making food tasty. But what a difference between how much and what kind of food I eat. Not because my body needs it, but because my appetite loves it. And I stayed on that very prosaic topic of food. But do you get the logic?